A feathered river across the sky, the passenger pigeon's flight to extinction, is the story of how the once most numerous animal in North America, let alone maybe even the entire world, went from billions to extinction in about 50 years. Joel Greenberg, the author of that book, is research associate of Chicago's Field Museum and the Chicago Academy of Sciences' Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. He helped spearhead Project Passenger Pigeon and is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky. He blogs at birdzilla.com, and he joins me this morning on the Joy Cardine program. Joel Greenberg, good morning.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's a real honor and pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you tell a fascinating and tragic story of the demise of the passenger pigeon. Tell us a little bit about this bird. Most of us probably confuse it with something else, but let's start out by telling us what is a passenger pigeon, or what was the passenger pigeon?
Okay. The passenger pigeon was unlike any other bird that human beings have ever known, and for three principal reasons. One is, as you said, it had a huge population. We don't know how many for sure there were because there was no field surveys, no scientific scrutiny, but the premier passenger pigeon historian, A.W. Shorger, a badger, we could talk about him later, he came up with a figure of from 3 to 5 billion of these birds at the time Europeans arrived. Secondly, they often massed in huge aggregations. So this abundance wasn't cryptic. This abundance wasn't spread evenly across the landscape. John Audubon talks about a flight along the Ohio River between Henderson, Kentucky, and Louisville that eclipsed the sun for 3 days. There was a nesting in central Wisconsin, which we'll probably talk about as well. It spread across 850 square miles. And third, and you touched on it, is despite this abundance, human beings slaughtered the birds unremittingly and so pervasively that from probably over a billion birds as late as 1860, the last wild birds were killed in the beginning of the 20th century, and the last of the species, and it's rare that we know the almost exact hour that a species ceases to breathe, occurred when Martha, the last passenger pigeon, died about 1 o'clock in the afternoon on September 1st, 1914, in the Cincinnati Zoo. That gives you a sense of the bird.
Yeah, why are they called passenger pigeons?
Okay, and it's from the French, which is not a language I speak well. The idea is these birds were constantly moving. So you could see them anywhere in any time. The scientific name of the bird is Ectopistes migratorius, which makes the point as well, redundantly, in that Ectopistes migratorius means the wandering migrant. So from early on, people, you know, these big flocks would move in search of food. There's other birds like that today, like cedar waxwings, for example, that don't so much move north and south like other birds, but they follow the food supply.
Mm-hmm. So how are how were these passenger pigeons different from the pigeons that most of us are familiar with sitting on a statue someplace?
Okay, well, they're not similar at all. And the way I like to explain it is there's one living family of pigeons. There are about 300 species in that family. And if you think about mammals, there's a family of mammal called felines or cats. And to say that all pigeons are alike is to say that your kitty curled up on your sofa is the same as a tiger, is the same as a cheetah. So the passenger pigeon is a New World bird found in the eastern half of the United States and Canada. The pigeon you refer to, the rock pigeon, carrier pigeon, messenger pigeon, if you like, they are a European bird, partially domesticated, used by people to carry messages. They congregate in cities because they nest on cliffs, and in places like Madison and Chicago, we don't have any cliffs. So the closest analog are skyscrapers and, you know, bridges. So the birds are completely different. Rock pigeons don't. Mourning doves look a little, excuse me, passenger pigeons look a lot like mourning doves, if your listeners know that bird. They were bigger by probably a half, 1.5 times the size. The males had red breasts. Females were more beige below, bluer backs. When the light hit them, they were sometimes described as, you know, like rainbows, even as they flew and moved across the sky. So those are some of the principal differences.
Well, what is it that you have found so fascinating about the passenger pigeon?
Well, a number of things. The passenger pigeon's abundance really represents the richness of this continent. The pullulation of life here, which manifested itself in these huge flocks of pigeons, in millions of bison grazing on the Great Plains. I mean, this was an amazing place. And so the pigeon really represents that. Furthermore, unlike the bison I just mentioned, if you wanted to see passenger pigeons, you didn't have to travel to western Kansas or remote areas. They would fly over Chicago and Madison and Philadelphia and Toronto and Montreal and New York. And there were days of the year, and it varied, not every year, where the sun would be darkened for hours at a time. So just minding your own business, in Cleveland, you would look up and there would be times where you'd see these clouds of birds. So they affected American culture because they were known, you know, widely by people. And I guess another factor, which you can't get away with, of course, or can't move from, is how they did become extinct at the hands of people in such a short period. That's unprecedented.
Yeah, why did we kill these pigeons? I mean, were they good to eat? They were a fairly decent sized bird, as wild birds go. But what was it about them that caused us to want to shoot them or otherwise get rid of them?
Well, I mean, mostly it was they were easy to get at. They were abundant, as I've said. They were the cheapest terrestrial protein, and so while people shot them and netted them, those were the two principal ways that they were taken. From the beginning, from when from Europeans first arrived, and Native Americans used them as well. But it was really the expansion of the railroad and telegraph in the 1840s that enabled national markets for these birds to develop. So birds killed in northern Michigan could be brought to railroad tracks and sent to St. Louis, Chicago, and cities to the east. So they provided cheap food for the burgeoning cities of the country. Telegraphs meant that wherever the birds were, that information could be shared widely. And so starting in the 1860s, maybe even in the 50s, you had professional pigeoners who spent the entire year chasing the birds from their nesting grounds in the north to roosting grounds in the south and everywhere in between, doing nothing but hunting them. So mostly it was cheap food.
Mm. What niche did the passenger pigeon fill in nature? I mean, what was their impact on the ecosystem and where were they in the food chain?
Well, that's an excellent question. And unfortunately, because they were never studied, we don't know for sure. It's inconceivable to me that you could have so much life, both present and then so much life removed, without it impacting other creatures. They ate lots of different things, but they clearly preferred nuts, particularly from oak and beech. And so modern scientists have looked back and have come up with some interesting ideas. In fact, one ornithologist who's a UW Madison graduate, David Blockstein, came up with this interesting idea that the presence of the birds kept Lyme's disease low, because Lyme's disease concentrates in mice, Paramyscus, a certain kind of mouse that likes acorns and beech nuts. So by competing with these mice for food, the population of mice were kept at some steady rate. So they were never able to populate enough for the disease to become widespread enough. So that's one idea. They altered the forests that they nested in and roosted. So many of them would land in these trees that branches would break. I mean, whole trees were known to topple. These were even, they nested or roosted in scraggly willows, but also big, stately hardwoods like oak. And so by breaking these branches, they opened up the canopy, which dried up the floor and provided tinder with all this broken branches. And so consequently, they promoted fire. And fire has a profound impact on ecosystems. And so fire, woods that are burned, often promote oak, for example, a thicker barked tree than, say, maple. So that's one. It's another impact that has been suggested. In the South, there was an ecosystem called canebrakes. A couple of birds seem to rely on them. They've now shrunk so that they're no longer really important ecosystems. But one ecologist has suggested that basically cane is bamboo, and they lived in and they thrived in areas of disturbance that were burned or along rivers. So one of this guy's ideas, Reed Noss is his name, suggested that the pigeons helped keep these cane breaks intact. And so there's yet another possible impact that the bird had.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our discussion about the passenger pigeon. Does the story of the passenger pigeon strike a chord in you? How much does its extinction matter to you? Should scientists attempt to clone the bird and bring it back from extinction? That's an idea that's been floated. And, well, what questions do you have for our guest, the book under discussion this hour is A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. Naturalist Joel Greenberg is my guest this hour. You can join us, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave your comment or question on Facebook. Go to the Joy Cardeen Show Facebook page and you can post there. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardeen. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The passenger pigeon. We're noting, not celebrating, we're noting the 100th anniversary this year of the extinction of a bird that once numbered in the billions across North America, the eastern half, at any rate, United States and Canada. We're talking about the book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. My guest is Joel Greenberg, Research Associate of Chicago's Field Museum and the Chicago Academy of Sciences' Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. He helped spearhead Project Passenger Pigeon. We'll ask him about that in just a moment. And is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky. He's also co-producer of a forthcoming documentary on the passenger pigeon, and he blogs at birdzilla.com. Well, Joel Greenberg, before we go on, tell me about a Project Passenger Pigeon. What's that all about?
Sure. When I started research for my book, I learned that other people, in part the research was spawned by the realization that 2014 would be the centenary of the bird's extinction. So the last bird died in 1914. And I learned that other people were interested in this anniversary as well. Eventually, on February of 2011, the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum hosted a meeting bringing together people from all over. And out of that was Project Passenger Pigeon. And what we want to do is familiarize people with this amazing story and then emphasize the lessons that are relevant today. You know, the idea that even though something's abundant and it could be water, it could be fuel or something alive, if we're not careful, we can lose it. And so we try to get that out through lots of means. My book is one. We have a website, passengerpigeon.org, the documentary that we're making. We have a host of exhibits and projects using arts and music, articles. Birdwatching Magazine has an article that just came out. They're published in Milwaukee. New Yorker, New York Review of Books has written about it. Audubon Magazine, Orion. So we're hoping to use a lot of different media in different ways, different means to touch people and reach them and get them to think about how we, with 7 billion human beings on the planet now, more of us than there ever were passenger pigeons, how we can be better stewards.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program, which is what Ron in Duluth, Minnesota has done this morning. Let's go to the phones and hear from Ron. Ron, good morning.
I just wonder if today vast numbers of passenger pigeons, you know, without contiguous forests covering most of the country, would be considered pests like starlings are.
That's an interesting question. Would they be considered? I mean, they're native birds. They're not starlings. They're not urban birds like rock pigeons. You know, I don't think that we as a society would be happy with 100 million birds flying over as they passed over and the sun finally came out. The buildings were plated with white. I mean, there's a lot of droppings involved. But arguably, the birds, if they were protected, could certainly survive in much lower numbers. So in my mind, if they had survived, they probably couldn't have survived in those original numbers, but I think we could live with passenger pigeons.
Just to give you an idea of the scale of this thing, you talk in your book about an observation at Fort Mississauga in Canada of an overflight of these marvelous birds. Describe what observers saw that day, and there's been quite a bit of discussion about coming up with formulas to determine exactly how many pigeons were in that group, but it was a lot, and that. Probably that term probably doesn't do it justice, but could you just describe what people saw?
Sure. Major King was in the British Army, and he decided that he would come to Canada. He liked nature, and he would look at nature at Canada's forests and lakes and prairies. And in May, he was at Fort Mississauga, and in the morning, his servant came to him and said, take a look outside. And so for 9 hours, and then concentrated, and then extending over 2 days, was this remarkable flight of passenger pigeons. The great passenger pigeon historian, A.W. Shorger, made some calculations, assumed the birds were flying 60 miles an hour, and said that there were 3.7 billion birds. Now, I've thought about this a lot. So Major King, trained in the probably, certainly one of the great armies of his day, probably was trained in, you know, being able to estimate distance. Was he an alcoholic and, you know, delusional? That I don't really know, although I do know later he was promoted again, so presumably his peers thought well of him. Some scholars, I've had modern scientists look at it, and they pretty much agreed with Shorger's, except they thought the birds were probably flying less than 60 miles an hour. But even if they were only flying 35, which is closer to the speed of a mourning dove, they were close to 2 billion birds. So the amazing thing to me, John, isn't just the huge number, but that was in the early 1860s. And so, you know, this isn't 1800. And 40 years later, they were gone. And it's hard to get, you know, one's mind around it. In fact, 10 years later, in 1871, Shorger calculated what he or estimated the number of birds that inhabited the famous 1871 nesting centered on the Wisconsin Dells, spread 850 square miles. He said there were 136 million birds in that, and thought most of the pigeons in the world were there. Now, he missed some. There were other nestings. But, you know, the kinds of drops in population in those decades is just mind-boggling. But even if those numbers are high, we can say with certainty that there were vast numbers of birds, even if we don't know exactly how many there were.
Let's go to another call, and we'll hear from Sandy in Algoma next. Sandy, good morning.
Hi. The demise of the passenger pigeon, it makes me very sad, and it shows the blatant disregard that we have for other species on this planet. I mean, I can think about how many that we've really tried to wipe out, you know, the wolves, certainly the buffalo. I mean, the buffalo would have been wiped out completely if it hadn't been for the 26 or 27 of them that were hiding in Yellowstone. And the fact that we can think that we can treat the Earth as if we're separate from it is a big problem. And they really will come back to roost, and it's happening as we speak. You know, we're poisoning our water, we're poisoning the air, we're making a big mess, and this needs to change.
Sandy, thanks so much. Thanks so much for the call. Joel Greenberg?
Sure. I mean, it's a sad story if you end it on September 1st, 1914, but the passenger pigeon, along with the bison, along with the fight over the use of herons' terns for hats, spawned the country's first great environmental movement. And that movement left in its wake laws like the Lacey Act that prohibits the importation of illegally collected birds. More importantly, perhaps, the Migratory Bird Act, which regulates the taking of migratory birds. And it reflected the first time that the federal government assumed jurisdiction over migrating wildlife. That's really important. Without a strong sovereign, these things aren't going to be protected. So to that extent, the birds' loss, you know, created this positive aspect. And your caller is right. The pigeon, I mean, David Bloxine refers to four horsemen of extinction, and the pigeon represents one type of abuse, which would be the direct take. The closest analog, current analog, is what we're doing to the open seas with the taking of tuna, shark, and other fish. And it's for the same reason. There is no sovereign that can control international waters, so anybody can do what they want. But in addition to that, there's habitat loss, there's alien species, and there's pollution, which is a major factor behind climate change. So the reasons that things are being driven to extinction are maybe more complicated now. I mean, more complex as society, you know, becomes more complicated itself. We have to be concerned about these new threats. And those threats, pollution, for example, you know, helped spawn the country's second great environmental movement. Silent Spring was a clarion call that, you know, pollution and pesticides were wiping out birds. And we reacted, and we created laws like the Endangered Species Act, which unfortunately now is under attack in some circles. So I would encourage people, you know, to get involved with trying to keep the Endangered Species Act. But all of these things that happen, and your caller's right, hopefully we learn something from it and can proceed in a somewhat more circumspect manner.
Sandy, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Kenosha next and hear from Mark. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting show. I had a question regarding whether there's data on the population of these birds in the, you know, prior to 1492. And the reason I ask is that a history book I wrote, aptly named 1493, and the author's name escapes me, speculated that the population of the birds was not so enormous prior to the European colonization because the Indians were eating it. And then the Indians, their population dropped by 90%, and that caused an explosion of the bird population. Is there any information you run across as far as what the population of the bird might have been in, say, 1400?
that idea was advanced by an archaeologist named Newman, and it was published in Mann's first book, 1491. And unfortunately, not only is there's been studies. I mean, he based it on the idea that archaeological digs had few passenger pigeon remains. Now, Professor Jackson at University of Southern Mississippi did a paper and found that Newman seems to have overlooked lots of places where there were lots of bones. But finding bones is used by people is not really a measure of abundance. Bird bones don't preserve well. The nature of passenger pigeons, they weren't in the same place year after year generally, meant that they weren't widely used by most groups of native people. And there's a lot of reasons why that notion isn't so. The very first Europeans to arrive, people like Cartier, saw huge flocks of birds. And, you know, the genetic research that's being done also suggests that you know, these birds didn't just suddenly become common. So there's no reason to doubt that you know, the birds were abundant well before Europeans arrived.
Mark, thanks for your call. There's a comment here from Facebook. Gary writes, I have always found it hard to believe that passenger pigeons went extinct solely due to hunting. I am guessing that disease probably played a greater role. I also can't imagine that any species with as dense a population as was reported could be good for the environment.
Well, I mean, the fact that these things you know, evolved out of this very rich forest and environment. You know, the idea of good or bad didn't exist then. I mean, there was enough food to sustain them. If there wasn't, then they would not have been as abundant. Other things fed hawks. I mean, things with wings fed on them in their nesting areas. Terrestrial mammals fed on them. So, the idea that they weren't good for the environment when they, you know, evolved over, you know, millennia in that environment strikes me, you know, as false. The idea of disease has been brought up from the beginning. The problem is there's absolutely no evidence of that. So bats today. White nose syndrome is killing bats, and they're finding caves filled with dead bats. There were never huge numbers of passenger pigeons just laying there dead. You know, is it possible that there was some disease that affected them in some more subtle, nuanced way? Probably. There's no evidence of it. And I'm hoping that with a lot of the new genetic research that's being undertaken with the species, maybe we can find some of that. But the problem is that all these other notions, there's just no evidence of it.
So help me understand here, and going back to the observations at Fort Mississauga when there was this three-day flyover of all these passenger pigeons numbered somewhere in the billions, depending on who's counting. Did all of the passenger pigeons in America, I mean, were they all together all the time? Were there different groups scattered across the landscape? Help me understand how they how pigeon society was organized, if it was.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things about, say, the Mississauga, that wasn't all the pigeons that were in the U.S. And Canada. So the birds gathered and bred in pairs like robins. They bred in smaller numbers, hundreds. And they nested in these huge masses and roosted by a few birds and in huge masses. So we don't really know much about these smaller aggregations because nobody ever studied them. I mean, basically, when people encountered the birds, they killed them. So to answer your question, I mean, the concentrations were largely determined by masting events. So acorns form in great numbers every so number of years. A beach, it could be anywhere from, I don't know, 4 to 8 years, and then you have the surfeit of nuts, just like periodic cicadas. This is an insect which every 13 or 17 years erupt, and the idea is that with all those acorns or all those insects, they'll be plenty to survive and breed for the next time around. So to answer your question, they tended to be distributed in the most part in these large concentrations by where their preferred food was. Does that help?
Sure. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're talking about the passenger pigeon today and its extinction. 100 years ago this year, 1914, the last passenger pigeon died. The book under discussion is A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. Jill Greenberg is the author of that book, and he is my guest this hour on the Joy Cardine program. You can join us as well. Does the story of the passenger pigeon strike a chord with you? How much does its extinction matter to you? Do you think about it at all? Should scientists attempt to clone the bird? Maybe we can talk about that when we come back. I know there have been proposals about bringing back other species that are extinct. Should we bring back the passenger pigeon? Well, that's all up for discussion here on the Ideas Network this morning. And before we go to break, let's take another call. We'll go to Jacob in Burlington next. Jacob, good morning.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I think it's a real grief that we've lost this species, but I'm fascinated by it. There's a term in our vernacular language that would have been understandable to people who experienced this. It's called the stool pigeon, which my understanding was the decoy bird they would tie to a branch stuck in the ground called the stool, and it could fly around on this rope, and it would attract other passenger pigeons in because they thought it was a feeding area, and then they would net the bird. So we have this term called the stool pigeon that, until I read an article last year, I had no idea where it came from, and I doubt many people do. I just like your guest comment.
You're dead on. You're absolutely right on that. There were some really sophisticated netting operations, and they actually had two kinds of live decoys. They had what were called flyers, and if a big flock flew over, they'd let these flyers on long ropes fly around to attract the attention of the wild birds. And then they would get the stool pigeons. The stool pigeons tended to be blinded. They sewed their eyelids together so the birds would remain calm. They were on a stool that was on kind of a teeter-totter-like device. And so when the wild birds came by, they'd see these calmly feeding live decoys. And then hopefully, from the standpoint of the pigeoners, the birds would come in. So that's exactly how that term came into our parlance. A sort of a traitor to one's own kind would be another way probably to describe it.
Thanks so much for the call. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have some more callers. You could be one of them. There's room for you right now at 800-642-1234. You can always send us an email. talk@wpr.org is the address. And you can find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Joel Greenberg is my guest. The book is A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. And Joel Greenberg, when we come back, let's talk about whether or not we should maybe try to bring the passenger pigeon back through cloning, and if that's even possible. These things are discussed now because of advances in science, but sometimes what science gives us as a possibility might not be the best idea. We'll talk about that a little bit when we come back, and we'll take your calls and questions as well. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the passenger pigeon. 100 years after the last passenger pigeon passed away, we're discussing their demise. Book under discussion, A Feathered River Across the Sky. Joel Greenberg is its author. He's with us now. Joel Greenberg, there's been some talk about cloning extinct species, the opportunity to maybe take some DNA and do whatever it is you do with that and make new birds or dinosaurs or whatever. If we could bring the passenger pigeon back, do you think that would be a good idea?
Well, I know the folks that are working on bringing back passenger pigeons, and they want to do is extract DNA from passenger pigeons and then modify a close living relative, in this case the band-tailed pigeon of the West. And some of those folks are pretty confident that they can do it. Even if I think there's lots of challenges, because even if they can do it, passenger pigeons pigeons look a lot like mourning doves, and so you'd have to, which are hunted in most states. So there's a lot of social issues you'd have to deal with as well. So there's lots of challenges involved, although, again, these really smart, you know, people are interested in proceeding. They understand the ethical issues. They understand, you know, it's going to have to be regulated and the like. I guess what I get out of this, from my perspective, is, and particularly, I mean, again, I know some of these folks, one of whom is Ben Novak, who's working on the pigeons, is that the story of the bird and its abundance really touches people. You know, it caused me to do this book and this work. There's a novelist named Amy Timberlake from Wisconsin who writes novels about young people, and she just wrote a novel which involves passenger pigeons. Ben Novak's been interested in passenger pigeons since he was a kid, and he went into genetics, and, you know, this is something he wants to do. So I think that, you know, the story still touches us, and it manifests itself in different ways. And so I'm, you know, curious to see how it carries through. There never will be, in my view, the kinds of flocks, the kind of wonder that we've been talking about. There might be some small number of birds produced, perhaps even existing in the wild, but I can't imagine that it could replicate what makes this bird so
special. Well, and we might not even want it to. I mean, I'm trying to imagine.
Oh, that's right. Oh, no.
You know, 3 billion birds flying over Madison. I mean, that's just inconceivable.
Oh, it is, and I agree with you. I mean, you know, people have mused. I mean, you asked about the impact. You know, aviation, you know, with the Wright brothers in Ohio and automobiles in Michigan. I mean, if there had still been hundreds of millions of passenger pigeons flying, you know, high and low, you know, might have affected where those technologies developed. But I don't think that's what, you know, that's not what they're talking about. We can live, you know, hundreds of thousands of sandhill cranes fly over Madison and Chicago, and we live with those, and there's still millions of blackbirds and different things. So as a society, you know, we can accommodate some of this. And, you know, with recreating this, and you're right, there are other animals that they're looking at. I guess I see challenges in it. And, you know, these folks are sort of committed to going forward with it. And, you know, there's things you have to be really careful about. You know, technology can get us in trouble, and
often does.
It often does. I mean, anything that changes, you know, for a good, you change a job because you didn't like your boss, and you go to a new place, and you like your boss, but you don't like the 3 people sitting around you. I mean, any change you make, you know, has hopefully good things, and it has bad things, and it's often very difficult to predict what those bad things are. So I think that, you know, for this to be successful, people have to be very cognizant of these potential harms. And I think that at least the folks I know personally involved are. So I'm kind of ambivalent, but, you know, standing back and curious how it all will move forward.
Give us a sense, if you can, Joel Greenberg, of what it was like to live in a time when these birds were alive and thriving.
Well, you know, it sort of depended on where you were. If you were in a rural area, you probably grabbed your gun and, you know, went out and shot birds or netted birds to augment your income. There's an account of clouds of birds flying over Columbus, Ohio, in the 1850s, and you know, they heard this hum and they looked in the distance and saw these clouds, and then as the clouds approached, it blocked the sun, and people dropped to their knees in prayer, thinking the end times were here. Horses got fidgety. You would get cold. There'd be a chill from the downbeat of hundreds of millions of wings, and, you know, an hour later, the birds would move off. You know, there were places in Manitoba, parts for example, where the birds did not congregate. So you'd be out in the woods and you'd see a pair here or a pair there, like you would mourning doves. So they definitely, you know, impacted people. And it inspired artists. America's first symphony composer was Anthony Philip Heinrich, and he wrote a 9-movement symphony called the Columbiad, or the Migration of the American Passenger Pigeon. It was played once in Prague in the 1850s, and it looks like the University of Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra will be performing it next fall. So there's an example of place names. Pigeon Falls, Wisconsin, the largest city in the country named after the passenger pigeon, is Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. So the bird had an impact on people. You couldn't look at these kinds of flights and not be moved by one way or another.
Let's take some more calls. We'll go to Mark in Viroqua next. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just recently had a renewed interest in the American chestnut. I'm a landowner, and I'm interested in improving my woods. And there's some hybrid chestnuts that are, you know, predominantly American crossed with Asian. But one of the things that I read in the book, and unfortunately I'm on the road, so I don't have the book with me, but the collapse of the American chestnut due to the blight that was introduced from Asian sources, I guess, seemed to coincide with the collapse of the passenger pigeons, and the American chestnut was a very prolific food source. And so to me, like many of these things, they are not necessarily as simple as they look on the surface. It's probably multifactorial, but I was wondering if our guest could comment on if he's looked into this hypothesis at all, and if he could comment on it. And
Mark, thanks for the call. Joel Greenberg?
Sure. First of all, chestnuts appeared not to be a major part of the pigeon diet. They were on the big side of what pigeons ate. They are known to have eaten them, but a small part of their diet. More importantly, the collapse of American chestnuts happened decades after the pigeon collapse. So there is no connection between the loss of the bird and that of a chestnut.
Thanks for the call. They ate acorns, but I didn't know until I read your book, they swallowed them whole.
Yeah, pigeons have something called a crop, and it's this like little pocket by the esophagus, and they would eat them whole. As many as 10 or 11. I mean, people talked about when shooting them and they'd fall and they'd actually rattle. Customarily do is then fly to a perch, and over hours, those nuts then would, you know, go from this crop into the stomach and be digested. So, yeah, exactly. They like 41 genera of plants. They ate insects, you know, fruit. They ate lots of things. But again, during breeding season in particular, the high protein in these nuts probably contributed, you know, to a successful nesting.
Kent in Platteville, let's go to you next. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I'm a retired school teacher here, and I give presentations on, for the Grant County Historical Society to different groups at schools, et cetera. And years ago, Ilona Kinchy, who's passed away, she had all kinds of good history stories, especially folklore. And she used to talk about the passenger pigeons. And he backed up some of her statements here, because about the sunlight would be dark in the sky, and the crickets and the frogs would start chirping, she said, and croaking. And then they also, on downtown Platteville, people would holler that the flight was on, and they'd run out on the street and shoot one bullet, and it would kill several birds at a time. And she also talked about how that bird droppings fell like gentle rain. And we used to take the sixth graders to Wyalusing State Park, where there's a monument to the passenger pigeon. And one story that I heard then, I wonder if he could tell us about that, that they would shake the trees and the baby birds would fall, and they'd scoop them up and club them and pick them up with shovels and put them in buckets. And finally, I'd just like to mention that there are two stuffed passenger pigeon birds at the Grant County Historical Society Museum in Lancaster, Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much, and that's I'm really glad for your call. And I was, John, going to mention this. There are five or six states in particular, in Ontario, where the passenger pigeon was a really important part of their history. And Wisconsin is one of them. I mean, there's lots of libraries and historic, not lots, but you can find passenger pigeon specimens, you know, in various places. And the history of the towns, the pigeon was such an important part of the history of Wisconsin, and as well as in part, too, to people like Schorger and Leopold, who wrote about them, that, you know, as a part of Wisconsin's legacy, this is an important bird.
Did anyone raise the alarm about the demise of the passenger pigeon when there might have still been time to do something about it? Was anybody paying attention and saying, hey, you know what, we're killing an awful lot of these birds. We might want to slow down a little bit?
Easy answer, really not. I mean, there's a few people who had concerns. John Audubon maybe was one of the first to explore the question of whether hunting could wipe them out, and he got it wrong. He said, no, they can't, as long as the trees stand. But Audubon also thought they lay two eggs and nest multiple times. There was a French guy named... now I'm blinking out, but who did say that hunting would wipe out the birds in about the same time as Audubon. One of the most interesting examples of somebody protesting the killing of the bird is Junius Brutus Booth, a famous actor of his day, and more famously the father of John Wilkes Booth, but he loved animals and hated killing. And so he was performing in Louisville in the 1830s when there were flights of pigeons, and he was appalled at the slaughter, and he actually reached out to a minister, James Freeman Clark, a very famous, well-known Unitarian minister, and asked him if he would preside over a funeral as a protest for the birds. So that stands, you know, unique in the literature. It wasn't until later, really in the 1870s, that people started to talk about it. There were state laws that controlled the taking of these birds, but they weren't very well enforced. Actually, the very first law that was passed was in Massachusetts in the, like, probably 1830s or so. That actually was designed to protect netters, pigeon netters, from pigeon shooters who would come and disturb the birds. So some of the early laws actually, you know, didn't help the birds at all. But basically, you know, there wasn't any effective action taken to try really to protect the birds, just sporadic incidents here and there.
Well, you know what? Just looking at the clock, we are out of time, just like the passenger pigeon was in 1914. Thank you so much, Joel Greenberg, for spending this hour and for writing this marvelous book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The book is A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction, written by naturalist Joel Greenberg, research associate of Chicago's Field Museum and the Chicago Academy of Sciences' Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. He blogs at birdbiz.com. This program was produced by Christy Taylor, and Bill Martins handled direction, and Christy Taylor also handled on-air production for us this morning. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to the authors of The Outrage Industry about the rise of anger and negativity in the media. No kidding. You should be outraged. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.